The only one who will really pay the tariffs, the impact of the tariffs, most likely will be Chinese consumers.
Trade wars intensify, as timing may help some. It's Monday, June 25th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Australia confronts forced marriage, changes for Malaysia media, Indian Sikhs on patrol in New York. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Retaliating against the Trump administration's tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, India has raised duties on 29 U.S. goods worth about $240 million. New Delhi made the announcement last week after Washington ignored its request to be exempted from the tariffs because its exports were tiny compared to others, such as China and the European Union. India accounts for about 2% of American imports of steel and aluminum, or $1.5 billion in sales. India is the latest country to hit back against U.S. President Donald Trump's tariff increases on steel and aluminum imports. Meanwhile, U.S. soybean farmers are waiting to see how the tariffs with China will impact their substantial exports to the world's second-largest economy. John Bays of the U.S. Soybean Export Council tells VOA Mandarin reporter Monica Su that the initial impact appears to be minimal, which Chinese consumers seem to be facing the biggest inconvenience of higher prices.
Number one, we won't know if it really goes into effect until I think it's 6th of July. So there's still opportunity for both sides to reach an agreement that avoids this. But if it does go into effect, I think the immediate effect will be relatively minor impact on the U.S. because we're exporting very few soybeans to China now, and we will export very few the rest of the year until about October. We normally don't export much until about October. If they're still in effect after October, then the U.S. undoubtedly will begin to export more soybeans to markets other than China, while South America in particular ships more to China. But it's interesting because a substantial importer into China was traveling in the Midwest, and he was met with a farmer, and that he said he did not expect China to import hardly any less soybeans from the U.S., than it did this year under the new tariff situation, because it cannot get what it wants from the rest of the world. And in fact, he said the only one who will really pay the tariffs, the impact of the tariffs, most likely will be Chinese consumers who have to pay more. And animal producers have to pay more for the soybean meal to feed their animals. So that was his opinion, and he's a major importer. So it ultimately may not prove to be that big a deal with respect to soybeans, because China must import over 100 million tons of soybeans next year to supply its animal industry and to supply its food, soybean oil for the consumer, if it wants to feed the people and meet the standards of living which they have now.
You said the impact on soybean growers will be limited because right now it's a growing season, planting season. So there's some time for both sides to negotiate.
Right. The short-term impact on our exports will be relatively small. When it becomes a problem, maybe, is after we begin to really harvest our crop in September. And that crop meets the market and we need to export. But the problem is that Brazil harvested its crop. It's the primary supplier of soybeans to China is Brazil. It harvested its soybean crop beginning in January and February and March. It will not have another crop until February, March of next year. Its total exports are going to be about 72 million tons. So what does China do for soybeans after its imports from Brazil run out? And you can't get any more from Brazil. The only place it's going to be able to get any quantity of any size is the U.S.
John Bays of the U.S. Soybean Export Council speaking with VOA Mandarin reporter Monica Su. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. Return of U.S.-Korean war vets' remains draws nearer. Singapore says Trump-Kim summit cost just $12 million after some question on expenses. Malaysia's former Prime Minister Najib Razak net tightens. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Campaigners are urging Australia to do more to stop forced marriages in its migrant communities. Since the practice was made illegal 5 years ago, more than 230 alleged cases have been referred to the Australian Federal Police, but there have been no prosecutions. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Since forcing an individual to marry was criminalised in Australia in March 2013, there have been no successful prosecutions. The police say that doesn't reflect the work they do to successfully prevent or disrupt forced marriages. Campaigners say most victims are girls under the age of 18, but many are unwilling to go to the authorities, fearing isolation or retribution from their families and communities. There's also a reluctance to speak to the police or start a criminal case against a relative or friend. Jennifer Byrne, the director of Anti-Slavery Australia, a campaign organisation, says the true scale of the problem is unknown.
I have no doubt that there are many more in the community who are unidentified, who are either in a forced marriage or facing a forced marriage.
Bial Daraj ran away from her home in Australia after two older sisters were forced to travel to Iraq to marry.
Seeing what they were going through really terrified me, and I didn't want to experience it. I argued as much as I can, stalled as much as I can, and then around 15, I just had enough and ran away because I knew, like, within a week I would have been married if I'd stayed at home.
Earlier this year, the Australian government announced a year-long trial to make it easier for victims to get help. Under the project, they can seek support without the involvement of the police. The government in Canberra states that forced marriage is a slavery-like practice, a form of gender-based violence and an abuse of human rights. Britain introduced a similar law to outlaw forced marriages in 2014, where the first prosecution has just finished. In Australia, this type of crime has affected women and girls from migrant Middle Eastern communities and others from Bangladesh, Afghanistan, India and Pakistan. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The surprising upset in Malaysia's May elections not only ushered in a new governing coalition, but it might also mean major changes for the media, which were largely under the previous government's control. Dave Grunbaum has the story for VOA from Petaling Jaya, Malaysia.
At the offices of the news site Malaysia Kini, there's enthusiasm about what might be a new dawn for press freedom in Malaysia.
I am pretty optimistic that, you know, somehow things will be different. Of course, it's still too early.
Too early to tell because changes just started in the aftermath of the May elections, which marked the first victory by the opposition since Malaysia gained independence from Britain more than 60 years ago. For decades, the country's mainstream media was largely under the government's thumb. Political parties and businesses with ties to them and the government owned major press outlets. The government made it difficult for independent news outlets like Malaysia Kini that did not toe the official line to get licenses to broadcast and print newspapers as well as magazines.
It was definitely, you know, outright censorship because the government could say to and would say to the print and the broadcasters, you cannot cover this.
A prime example, allegations of massive corruption against Prime Minister Najib Razak, who was ousted in the recent election. The mainstream media's coverage often played down or dismissed this issue. This prompted voters like Kevin Kaur to turn to alternative sources like Malaysia Kini.
People do generally do not trust the mainstream media before the general election. Right? And people will go to the alternative media on the internet to look for a better and fairer news report.
The new ruling coalition's campaign promises include free speech, but it's unclear if they'll stick with it. The current Prime Minister, Mahathir Mohamad, held the job once before from 1981 to 2003, a time when he did not have a rosy relationship with the media. Malaysia Kini has a press freedom wall that shows news outlets that have been shut down or suspended, including several during Mahathir's first stretch as Prime Minister.
It's pretty ironic, isn't it? I mean, you know, the fact that you have a Prime Minister now who, who during his first, stint as Prime Minister is never known to be, friendly to the media, definitely an enemy of the press. And the fact that he managed to win this second election, to return as Prime Minister, he won it on the back of, the free media, on the back of independent media.
Malaysia Kini pledges that it will be just as tough on the new regime as the old one. But what type of climate the press will face in this country is a story that cannot be written just yet. Dave Grunebaum for VOA News, Petaling Jaya, Malaysia.
Coming up, Indian Sikhs are helping New York City and its streets stay safe. You're listening to VOA Asia. This news from VOA Asia, the U.S. military has relocated wooden coffins containing the remains of 100 American soldiers who have been missing from the 1950 to 1953 Korean War to the inter-Korean border in preparation for North Korea's eventual return of the remains to their home country. Visit VOA Asia Facebook today for all the best stories and features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, in New York, auxiliary police officers act as a liaison between communities and the police department. They assist about 36,000 regular officers maintaining law and order throughout New York's five boroughs. Recently, Gersach Kerr made headlines when she became the first female Sikh officer to serve in the auxiliary unit wearing a dastar, the traditional Sikh turban. Usually, dastars are worn by Sikh men, but some women choose to wear them to raise awareness about their religion. VOA reporter Anshuman Apte spoke to Gersach Kerr to learn why she made that choice and how the community is reacting to it.
Gersach Kerr joined the New York Police Department's auxiliary program when she was 20. She saw it as more than just a job. It also offered a perfect way to practice the selfless service that her faith, Sikhism, calls on its followers to do. Wearing a dastar, the turban usually worn by Sikh men, was another way to demonstrate her faith.
After I found out the significance of the turban, it's considered a crown, and then I figured, why not wear my crown if I'm given it? And it's a great opportunity of showing others and telling them who we are. And because I wear a turban, people ask questions, oh, why do you wear that? And from there, I'm able to tell them about my faith and why I follow it.
The auxiliary police is a voluntary force. Any New Yorker of legal age and status can join. Unlike the regular police, the auxiliaries don't carry guns, but they are trained in various skills, including self-defense, CPR, state law, and patrolling techniques. After finishing training, the auxiliary officers are deployed in various communities throughout the city.
The auxiliary officers are the eyes and ears of the police department. They assist the officers. If they see anything going on, they will call and, to call police officers, and they will assist with the officers with doing outreach to the community. They are the bridge between the community and the police department as well.
Besides serving the NYPD auxiliary police, Gersach Kerr is also pursuing her education. After graduating from college, she hopes to join the NYPD as a regular police officer. Anshuman Apte, VOA News, New York.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find our program online at iTunes and SoundCloud. Also streaming on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. You'll find us, too, on the radio. We thank everyone who's tuned in to U-Radio of Hachai University, FM 101.25 at Hachai University in Thailand. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineers, Zainab Abdel-Rahman. Managing Editor Diane Gao and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.